Thank you, gentlemen.
And, you know, again, reaching down to the bottom of this, it no system is absolutely perfect, no matter how good you are. You're going to have
Pacifica.
Yeah,
we know that.
So a good, the best internal control system that you can implement will provide reasonable assurance that what you're doing and that what you're doing, the information is accurate or reliable, but it's only reasonable. And again, it's because you cannot afford to implement any. Nobody can afford to implement a system that will guarantee perfection. It's just going to cost more than the benefits that you really get out of it. And some of you are engineers here, so you know the concept of tolerance. Or again, the limitations on internal controls are really all human related. You know, there, people make judgments which may or may not be good. Things break down, and once again, even though you do your best to get the best people that you can, sometimes things happen and management will override a control. And then, of course, there's also the possibility of collusion. And as I mentioned, keep the benefits in mind when you're thinking about what costs you want to incur to implement it.
Okay. So that ends. Any comments on Noel's part? We're starting to run out of time, but I wanted to spend a few minutes and talk about the P&B checklist. You know, it's tough for us to sort of, as I said, when I first volunteered to, you know, offered to come down to meet with you, I said I already had a vision in my mind that I knew this was not going to be, probably this was not going to be just a 2 or a 4 hour presentation, that really what we're starting to do is take a walk down a trail. So I sort of have a vision in my mind that, you know, bit by bit we'll start moving down this process. So really what this next section is what I've called P&B checklist. And it's not dealing so much with the specifics of some of the issues that we've got, but I want to start at the top and start going through some of these. First off, I want you to start thinking about developing some checklists. And by the way, and the first item is insider transactions and conflicts of interest. Develop a policy where you understand, not understands, there's an extra S, there's an S in there that doesn't belong, and fully comply with the laws regarding compensation of officers and benefits provided to directors and executives. Now, that's not been an issue in this organization. But it's something that nevertheless you have to keep in your focus, that you're a public organization. You can't benefit as members individually from this organization. The checklist should make sure that there's no loans to directors and executives. Now, in some cases, loans are necessitated. You know, we've got one of my clients a few years ago had to relocate their new ED from another part of the country, and they made a loan to that individual for housing needs. That was fully disclosed. Transparency was provided that there was no question that there was something untoward going on. Establish a conflict of interest policy. I think Nia and I have been discussing that over the last couple of years. Next is an audit committee. Establish an independent and competent audit committee, and you certainly have that. You conduct an annual audit. The board members, not only the board members, but the members of the audit committee, should be free from conflict, from any potential conflicts of interest, and not be compensated. It's reasonable to be expected to be reimbursed out of pocket expenses and so on, and you do comply with that. The next point is one have at least one financial expert on the board. It's critical, as well as maybe on the if not the finance committee, but also the audit committee. Make sure that there's somebody there that can fully understands our language. The audit committee should select the auditors, and you do that. Every year, NIA asks me to submit an RFP to her to do the work. Require the board to review the audit results. Obviously, we do that at some length, I'm very pleased to say. Provide financial literacy training. And we haven't gotten to that yet. We've started talking about it. In fact, you could say that this is part of it, sort of going through understanding controls. But at some point in time, we'd be delighted to come and talk to you about some of the semantics that we use, some of the nomenclature, rather, that we use in the financial statements and exactly what it means. Our responsibilities as your auditors. Rotate the lead partner every 5 years. Now, this is not a requirement. It is a requirement for publicly traded companies that they change the lead partner. It's not a requirement for not-for-profit organizations, but it's a good thing to have somebody come in and bring a fresh perspective. And that's why, you know, maybe a couple of years from now, Noel can step into my role and start asking different questions. Sean.
Yeah, I just wanted to know, because you bring up a good point, when you say change the partners, I've heard that it's good to change auditors every 3 or 4 years, and this is not a reflection on you guys, okay? Just because people do get chummy with their auditors and things, and it's not just lead partners, but you should change auditors. What's your take on that?
Obviously, I've got a conflict of interest.
Yes, I know. I was trying to think how to phrase this so that it wouldn't be a conflict, or in any way, this is not to be perceived as a critique of your work.
No. I appreciate and I understand what you're saying, Sean. I think there is. You have to establish a relationship with your client, because every so often you do come across difficult issues. And it's a lot easier to deal with those issues where, you know, Sean, I can call you or I can call Nia and say, Nia, I've got a real issue. And we've established a working history. You're right. After a few years, you know, I may not ask the questions. Even the PCAOB says that...
What's the acronym?
I'm sorry, the Public Companies Accounting Oversight Board.
Thank you.
This is the PCAOB was established to deal with publicly traded companies. They don't require a changing of audit firms. They recognize there's a significant cost to doing that. What they want is a new partner to come in. What they mandate is a new partner to come every 5 years to take a fresh look and ask those questions again. For some of my clients, I've been serving actually as their auditor. I become part of their institutional history.
Right.
Some of my clients I've served for over 20 years. How do I keep myself fresh? I ask Noel periodically to come in and take over those engagements, look over my shoulder, or I will then go and look over his shoulder. So we don't get jaded. We come back with a renewed sense of freshness. The other things that we have to avoid is conflicts of interest in between. We need to maintain that independence between you, management, and ourselves. Use the audit committee. Another part that we have to do is to, and I think we do this very effectively here, is to use the audit committee to prevent that conflict of interest, to make sure those policies and procedures. Nia and I communicate quite a lot on a very regular basis. She copies me on proposed policies and procedures, and we keep in contact, not just at the conclusion of the audit.
Thank you.
Certified financial statements. Again, this is part of the governance process. The CEO and the CFO should sign off on the financial statements, including the 990s, to make sure that they're fully compliant. This is actually required law under the PCAOB for publicly traded companies, but it's not a bad policy to have for even an organization your size. You should review and approve the tax returns and the financial statements. In fact, this year some very, very good questions came out of the audit committee with respect to the 990, and as a result of that, management's got a revised 990 that will be filed in the next couple of days. The numbers didn't change, it was just some of the disclosures. Make sure the other responsibilities in terms of disclosure, make sure all the financial information is timely, which I think we do a pretty good job of. Make sure that they're fully disclosed, and that ultimately we move to some forms of electronic filing of financial statements and tax returns. You've already taken a step in that direction in as much as your tax returns are publicly disclosed on your website. Other things, and this is something that's actually important. This has been discussed over the last couple of years. Develop a whistleblower policy. This is really important. This actually, I didn't realize how important this was until this spring, when in the course of our audit, when the senior accountant was doing her due diligence, talking about fraud and so on, and interviewing some of the staff. And this is not this organization. This is a different organization. I want to stress that. There was an allegation of fraud made. And that organization did not have a whistleblower per se, policy per se, to where this person felt that they could go and relay information. It actually, she had to wait until we came in, because particularly as this dealt with this, with the executive director of this organization, of the organization, she didn't feel that there was anywhere for her to go. It is important to have not only a whistleblower policy, to make sure that the employees understand that they're going to be protected, they're not going to be victimized, and then investigate those problems and then follow up on them, as well as report back to the employee to make sure that they understand that their policies have been addressed.
Yeah. Are you aware that in our ethics policy, we laid out a confidential and anonymous reporting thing, reporting apparatus, and along with California law, those two things now constitute our whistleblower policy, but we have had a problem getting it out. I know that George, in his due diligence, sent out the whistleblower policy to have all the employees sign off on it, but some wag, somewhere along the line, deleted the particular section that deals with the confidential and anonymous section. So we're a little behind in getting it out to the employees. And I do hope before this board's term ends that we do get everybody to read it and sign off on it.
Well, again,
it's in our, what I'm trying to say is it's in our ethics policy.
You know. Again, this is, you know, as the board of directors, I would challenge you to say, management, this is something that needs to be taken care of.
Immediately. Thank you, and I hope we take care of it immediately. It's very important to protect ourselves and our staff people.
Because of the nature of our governance organization, it's also required that the LSBs sign off on this, and we have had difficulty doing that, and that isn't something I can ask Arlene to do. It's something I have to ask the LSB chairs to do.
I have a question.
Don't we have a right to say to Arlene, make sure staff signs off on this?
It's so with staff, but it's not so with the LSB.
Yeah, well,
she has
no
authority
of the LSB. But I just want to make that distinction.
Yes.
We can say, Arlene, please make sure staff reads this and signs off, and our duty is to the LSBs.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I have a question. Now, I just heard Sean said that Georgie sent out the whistleblower policy and the ethics – no, sent the whistleblower policy that was signed. The As you know, the big controversy with the whistleblower policy that the audit committee developed, and actually was Sean himself who said that that's in the ethics policy. So I just need to be clear as a director. Is it that we now, what you sent out, was that the whistleblower policy that the audit committee developed, or was it the ethics policy? Because the ethics policy was...
The ethics policy by vote of the board became part of the whistleblower policy. So our signing off on that is part and parcel of our whistleblower policy. There's another aspect to it, which has to do with posting things at the stations, which the staff has to do.
Right. Right. I am fully aware of all of that. Then the, I guess, what concerns me, the conflict of interest policy also, that was supposed to be the ethics policy. This one particular document, I just get a little concerned when all these things are piled up or put into that one ethics policy, and that's supposed to protect us. So am I just being overly cautious or what?
Your concern is perfectly, you're legitimate to make, but it is in fact the ethics that is the policy at the moment. I think what shows up for me here is the difficulty we have in follow through, even when we pass policies, in actually seeing to it that they happen. And I think we need to work a lot more on that. The question of is that a good policy or should we change it a bit and tweak it, I think is certainly perfectly legitimate to put on the agenda.
Yeah, I think it needs to.
Do you get signed statements back from all the board members every year saying that they're independent or they have no conflicts of interest?
No.
Maybe you should.
It hasn't been done since 2009. We did it in 2008, but it hasn't been done.
Well, you should do it every year.
I have a question. Rico Ross, KPFK. One of the problems I have is that every time we meet, we add. And we continue to add. And before you know it, we've got so much stuff, so many documents. And I think that instead of adding, sometimes we need to change, and we need to be concise with it so that it doesn't become so difficult. And sometimes we add things that are quite contrary to something else we've added the year before. So I think that's when you mention the word streamline, that's the word that kind of lights up in my head, that we have to find some way to be concise, but at the same time, be thorough. I remember when I bought my house, it was over 100 pages to sign. And I went, my God, surely they could have done this in fewer pages than 100 pages. And I was told by the person who was selling it, says next year it'll be 110 pages. The question I have for you, financial transparency, which is something that is a conversation that has been had. And I want to know, are there any cons to that? I know the pros, because everybody wants to know. It's a public station, so they want to know, they should be entitled to a certain amount of information. The board wants to know information. Some of that information may be, actually, people might be looking for the information to use against us. I don't know. What are the pitfalls of complete financial transparency? And the other question I had was, what is your take on arbitration? Because that's been a conversation that's been had, and there's been pros and cons.
The cons on financial disclosure, well, I think the biggest con is that... is that you're disclosing the information and your competitors will have access to it. Everybody will have access to it. So... you can probably disclose information in a manner that doesn't give away too much detail, but given displaying your financial statements, well, the 990, for instance, is publicly available, and that contains an awful lot of information. But I think if you look at that as being what you must disclose, then you'll certainly comply with the law, and I think you'll help the good users of the information get what they want to know, because everybody wants to give money to success. Success breeds success. Nobody wants to fund a failure. So putting the information out there on your website is good. The funders have access to it, and they'll give you some more information. Or give you some more money, we hope.
So should our CFO feel fine, like any time we ask for information, oh here.
No. You don't have to give any more than your the 990. Anybody can walk in the door and say, can I see your 990? And you must make it available.
I think...
I'm talking about the board members.
Board members.
You don't have to give detailed information by, say, breaking it down into the station level. It's just the organization as a whole is required to file the 990, which is a public document and is available to everybody who wants to get it, to see it.
But I think the question really revolves around transparency and whether it's adequate, you know, what's really considered adequate disclosure. Clearly, obviously, in financial transparency, you want the whole concept of that statement means, are we giving a fair and accurate representation of what's gone on in this organization? That does not mean to say we have to disclose how much Betty Smith made or John Doe made in terms of salary. That's not appropriate. But what is appropriate is understanding what the revenues, what the assets and obligations and the income and expenses of the organization are, perhaps down to a local station level. That's financial transparency. Now, but you touched on something else that I want to bring up. I know the boards that I've sat on, I've been asked to sign that information I receive as a board member is kept within that organization and not to be shared with others. You know, because after all, there is information that may not be appropriate to be disclosed or could be used, as Noel alluded to, could be used against the organization. So, you know, you have a moral and ethical obligation to this organization, to any information that you receive in your role as a board member, to limit it to within this organization, within this body.
And the question of arbitration.
We're CPAs, not lawyers, so I don't think we should go there.
I think that's a good comment.
All right. We're about out of time, and I want to thank Tony and Noel for this presentation. I have to say, although you characterized your role as bayoneting the wounded, I got that there's an offer of partnership here that I really respect and appreciate, and I'm looking forward, and I believe the board is looking forward to taking that up.
Well, thank you. As I said, when I see a client as enthused as this organization is about its organization, then we love to reciprocate because it makes our job easier, and it's obviously it's a pleasure working with people who care about their organization. So we'll be delighted to come back and sort of continue on down this path that we've done.
Thanks again.
Are you not going to give us that little list you gave us last time of suggestions?
I'm sorry?
Are you not going to give us that little list of suggestions you gave us last time?
Well, yes, you'll see that in January.
Mr. Chair, point of information.
Yes.
I looked at the agenda, and it says we're ending at noon, but we're coming back at 6 o'clock.
No, we're coming back at 1 o'clock.
Okay, but that's what I was going to ask. Are we going to have...
We have lunch prepared for us downstairs in the restaurant. There's a section...
When we come back, is that a closed or open session?
It's a closed session when we come back. It's downstairs in room.
University room is called. You go out the door, and the room sticks out in the window.
Okay, you lead us out at 5 minutes to one. Okay. This meeting, this section of the meeting is adjourned. Let's break for lunch, and we'll be back here at 1 o'clock.
No, not back here.
Back at the other place at 1 o'clock.
And what's it called again? The university room?
University room.
Thank you.